This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRS LP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVAO LP Athol, WDJ. Framingham.
Well, here we go with the reading of today's Boston Globe on the Talking Information Center. It is Wednesday, the 25th of February, 2026, and we say hello to Susan.
Good morning. My name is Susan, and I'm pleased to be here and sharing some of the news of the day with you. Our first article is entitled, Thousands in Massachusetts Still Without Power Following the Storm. The article had been submitted by Emily Sweeney and Nick Stoico. More than 175,000 customers in Massachusetts remained without power late Tuesday night following a massive nor'easter that brought high winds and record-breaking snow to southern New England. That number was down from about 240,000 customers who didn't have power Tuesday morning, according to the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency. Doug Foley, Eversource's president of electric operations in Massachusetts, said additional crews were being brought in from New Hampshire, western Massachusetts, and elsewhere to help restore power in the hardest hit areas. Eversource said Tuesday night that power restoration to its customers' base won't be complete until Friday, according to the statement. Quote, it will take days. It is a multi-day restoration, but that's really for the last couple of customers, end quote. Foley said at a press conference on Tuesday in Yarmouth. We'll be restoring today, and that will continue for the next couple of days. But the last couple customers, unfortunately, will be a couple of days out. This was a powerful and damaging storm, and our crews have been working around the clock as conditions allow to restore service safely. Chris Layard, Chief Operating Officer of National Grid New England Electric, said in a statement. We planned extensively for this event, staged crews ahead of time, and now we're fully focused on a multi-day restoration effort to get customers back quickly, online, and quickly and safely. Most of the power outages Tuesday evening were in Plymouth County, Cape Cod, and the islands, according to MEMA. As thousands of customers in Massachusetts wait for power to be restored, crews are working to assess the damage and make necessary repairs. Foley said two helicopters and drones are being used to help assess the damage, and additional snow removal equipment has been brought in so that crews can get where they need to go. Quote, our restoration philosophy is to do the largest circuits to pick up the largest customers as quickly as possible, Foley said. But as we get into the neighborhoods and get back into the backyards, it's a little bit difficult for the crews to trudge through the snow, identify what's wrong, and make the repairs. So just the fact that we're dealing with the wintry amount of snow that's down here, 27 to 30 inches of snow, it's going to take time for the crews to trudge through the snow and make those repairs. The strong winds and heavy wet snow took down trees and damaged electrical equipment, and the drifting snow and poor visibility made it difficult for crews to get around during the storm. The conditions on Tuesday were much better for crews to get work done, Foley said, and we're also getting additional resources over to Martha's Vineyard. We do have full-time employees over there, but we typically bring in additional contractors and tree crews to help out. And we're working closely with the Steamship Authority to get some additional resources over there. Foley thanked customers for understanding as crews work to get the lights back on for everyone. We know how difficult it is not to have electricity, and certainly a cold, wintry day here in New England is tough for all of us, and I do appreciate their patience, Foley said. We have everything we need to get the job done. With these types of conditions, the ability to get out, get our trucks there, and get our crews into the backyards is going to be difficult, but they are definitely up for the challenge, and I just want everyone to know that we're going to continue to work out until we complete our task. Our second article is from the Metro section of the Globe. It was submitted by Travis Anderson, Globe staff writer. State police seek external review of handling of alleged DUI crash. The state police Police have hired an outside firm to review the agency's protocols for serious on-duty crashes after a sergeant struck a medical van while allegedly drunk in December of 2023 in Woburn, and a disabled van passenger died the following month, a case now under investigation by prosecutors. The hiring of 21 CP Solutions, a Chicago-based law enforcement consultancy, was disclosed in a February 20th letter from State Police Colonel Jeffrey D. Noble to Middlesex District Attorney Marion T. Ryan. The trooper involved in the crash, Scott Quigley, 41, is assigned to Ryan's office and was suspended without pay late last month after his alleged impairment in the crash came to light in separate legal proceedings. Quigley was driving his unmarked cruiser that crossed the center line on Lexington Street about 5:30 p.m. on December 12th of 2023, colliding with a van carrying Angelo Scatino, 37, who died on January 13th, 2024, from, quote, serious personal injuries, end quote, sustained in the crash, court records show. Scatino's family has a lawsuit pending against the state police in connection with the crash, and a judge in January ordered Quigley's toxicology report to be provided to the family's counsel. Those results showed Quigley's blood alcohol level to be 0.114 at the hospital, records show, although Quigley has denied intoxication and expressed confusion about that result, according to his lawyer and court records. The legal driving limit is 0.08. Quote, I want to first acknowledge my sympathy for the family and loved ones of Angelo Scatino and express my commitment to fully explore and understand the facts and circumstances that led to his death and any role the department may have contributed to the tragedy, end quote, Noble wrote in his letter, which state police released to the media on Tuesday. The criminal investigation to the crash is being conducted by Suffolk District Attorney Kevin R. Hayden's office. No one has been charged criminally in connection with the collision. Quigley's lawyer could not immediately be reached for comment on Tuesday. In his letter to Ryan, Noble wrote that, quote, an independent review of the process is warranted, end quote, in addition to a state police internal affairs probe of specific individuals involved in the crash response. The outside review, Noble wrote, will proceed in parallel with the internal investigation affairs probe and the investigation by Hayden's office. Noble said 21 CP Solutions will look into policies about how serious on-duty incidents, supervisors' response, and documentation, among other areas. He said the firm will also examine case file governance and internal coordination, as well as the procedures that apply when a member involved in a serious incident is also a witness in a pending prosecution. Noble outlined several steps he's already taken to improve oversight, including requiring a captain to respond to any state police cruiser crash involving injury, according to the letter. In a statement this month, Ryan's office said state police didn't disclose that a person had died following a motor vehicle crash involving Sergeant Quigley until January 27th, more than 2 years after Scatino's death. However, a recent defense filing in a pending Lowell murder case that Quigley investigated said Ryan's office was informed of Scatino's death on February 16th of 2024 by the State Disabled Persons Protection Commission. A state police incident report from December 2023 said Quigley was asked about his whereabouts before the crash when he was formally interviewed days later. He stated he had an early morning call out to a scene regarding the death of an infant, the report said. He relayed the call out lasted several hours, and even after securing from the scene, he fielded multiple telephone calls with inquiries about the circumstances surrounding the death. An attorney for the Lowell murder defendant, meanwhile, had asserted that state police must have long known about Quigley's alleged intoxication during the crash because he filed for line-of-duty compensation for medical bills stemming from the collision. Our next article comes from the business page. Caregivers want state to take better care of them. The article was submitted by Allison Kuznitz, State House News Service. Caregivers supporting their elderly parents and spouses overwhelmingly want more state financial aid, while legislation that aligns with their desired relief remains stuck in committee at a time when state government is already scrutinizing every health care expenditure. Some 48% of caregivers say the state does not provide sufficient support for unpaid family caregivers, according to a new survey AARP Massachusetts released on Tuesday. The survey found 85% of respondents support establishing a state tax credit for caregivers, 74% support providing respite vouchers for caregivers, and 71% support paying spouse caregivers. The survey recorded bipartisan support for each. Just more than 1,100 registered voters ages 30 and up were interviewed in October, with AARP asking more detailed follow-up questions of caregivers. Quote, most Massachusetts caregivers have worked while providing care and have needed to adjust their work schedules by going in late, leaving early, or taking time off while working for an hourly wage, the AAP reports. 3 in 4 spend their own money to provide care, and over half face financial hardship. The survey comes as Massachusetts sees an explosion of older adults who are straining the state's care system, including services offered in-home and community-based setting. Governor Mara Healey's fiscal 2027 budget proposes a $1.06 billion for the Executive Office of Aging and Independence, a $92 million increase to keep up with surging home care and congregate caseloads. Her budget also features some cuts to MassHealth, including among personal care attendants, as officials look to rein in spending on services not required by the federal government. Caregivers in Massachusetts deliver more than 730 million hours of unpaid care annually, valued at over $15 billion, the AARP report said. Caregiving encompasses help with everyday activities like shopping, household chores, transportation, meal prep, managing finances, and medication management. Most caregivers are women with a median age of 56, and they are most likely caring for their mothers or their fathers, who have a median age of 74, the report said. More than half of these caregivers said they spent $100 to $1,000 providing care per month, and over half reported this is extremely varied or somewhat difficult for them. AARP supports legislation from Senator Joe Comerford and Representatives Michael Kuchmerich and David Rogers that would create a caregiver tax credit for up to $1,500, authorize respite vouchers of up to $1,500 for caregivers, and establish an advisory committee on family caregiving. The proposals had a hearing before the Revenue Committee in mid-September and have since languished. The Senate bill is under a pending extension order until June 25th, while the House bill requires action by March 18th, according to the Senate and House clerks. Caregivers could support eligible family members who are at least 18 years old, including a dependent spouse, parent, or another relative by blood or marriage under this bill. Respite services would offer short-term relief for family caregivers who support loved ones with chronic health conditions, disabilities, or functional limitations, according to the legislation. The AARP survey found 73% of respondents favor the creation of a family caregiving advisory council, and the legislation says it would be composed of state officials, advocates, caregivers, healthcare providers, and other stakeholders. Narrower legislation allowing spouses to serve as paid caregivers through MassHealth cleared the Committee on Children, Families, and Persons with Disabilities on February 2nd and is now in the custody of the Healthcare Financing Committee. The HCF committee sent a similar measure to study last session. The state currently offers a free family caregiver support program, which makes referrals to community services and resources, offering training and counseling, and provides respite care. The 2018 paid family and medical leave law also allows employees to take up to 12 weeks of job-protected paid leave to care for a loved one with a serious health condition, and that includes caring for a spouse or a parent. And now we move to an article that was submitted by Natasha Singer. It says, poll, more than half of teens use Chatbox for schoolwork. More than half of teenagers in the United States use artificial intelligence tools for help with their schoolwork, according to a new study from the Pew Research Center. 54% of teenagers ages 13 to 17 said that they had used chatbots such as OpenAI's ChatGPT or Microsoft's Copilot for tasks like researching school assignments or solving math problems, Pew said in a report published on Tuesday. In 2024, 26% of U.S. teens said that they had used ChatGPT for their schoolwork, according to a previous Pew study asking specifically about their use of the chatbot. That was a twofold increase compared with 2023, when only 13% of students said they used ChatGPT for school help, according to Pew, which is a nonpartisan research center. The latest report, based on a survey of 1,458 students and teenagers and their parents last fall, found that AI use among teenagers varies widely. While 44% of teens said they used AI for, quote, some or little schoolwork, 10% of teens said they turned to chatbots for help with all or most of their schoolwork. We are definitely seeing that the use of AI chatbots for help with schoolwork is becoming a common practice for teens, said Colleen McLean, a senior researcher at Pew and study co-author. The findings come amid a heated national debate over the spread of generative AI systems, which can produce human-sounding texts, create realistic-looking images, and making apps. AI proponents say schools must teach students to use and assess AI chatbots to prepare young people for a changing workplace need. Critics warn the bots can produce misinformation, mislead students, undermine critical thinking, and help lead to self-harm and facilitate cheating. Several recent studies suggest chatbots may hinder critical thinking and impede learning. In one study on reading comprehension from Cambridge University Press and Assessment and Microsoft Research, students assigned to take notes without using chatbots showed better reading comprehension than students assigned to use chatbots to help them understand a text passage. The Pew researchers asked teenagers a variety of questions about their views and their use of AI. Many young people use chatbots as multi-purpose platforms for learning, entertainment, advice, and companionship, the results show. Among the teenagers, 47% said that they had used chatbots for fun, while 42% said they used the tool to summarize content. A smaller group, 12%, said that they had used bots for advice or emotional support. The report also shed light on how teenagers are using AI tools for school. Nearly half of teens said that they had used chatbots for research, and more than 40% used AI for help solving math problems. More than a third said they had used bots to edit their own writing. The survey did not ask students whether they had used chatbots to write essays or generate other assignments, the kind of cheating problems that teachers across the United States have warned about. But nearly 60% of teens told Pew that students at their school use chatbots to cheat very often or somewhat often. The results, the report said, indicate that teenagers think, quote, cheating with AI has become a regular feature of student life. Our next article comes from the editorial opinion page. It was written by Renee Graham. The winter of Trump's discontent. On Monday, a day after Secret Service agents in a Palm Beach, County Sheriff's deputy shot and killed an intruder who breached the security perimeter of his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida. President Trump addressed the issue during an event at the White House. Quote, "I don't know how long I'll be around," he told his audience in the East Room. "Got a lot of people gunning for me," end quote. Trump survived two assassination attempts in 2024, and now Trump's biggest threat seems to be Trump himself. On the eve of the first State of the Union address of Trump's second term, a CNN SRR poll conducted last week revealed a presidency in free fall. On how Trump was handling his job, 63% disapproved. When asked whether Trump had the, quote, right priorities, 68% simply said no. Trump didn't inherit a mess, but on multiple fronts, he has created one, and he knows it. Among Latino voters who supported Trump in higher numbers in 2024 than ever before, the president's approval rating has dropped from 41% to 22% since last February. Trump's overall approval rating sits at a grim 36%. By any measure, this presidency is failing. But that's not what Trump or his cabinet gaslighters are saying, especially about the economy. Trump saying it once again. "I inherited a mess," Trump said last week about the economy under former Joe Biden. But this is the same economy that The Economist in October 2024 called the envy of the world. In the CNN SRR poll, 57% of respondents said the economy, cost of living was the issue they most wanted Trump to discuss in his State of the Union address. By more than 20 points, the economy outranked immigration, the state of democracy, healthcare policy, crime and safety, and foreign policy combined. Trump didn't inherit a mess, but on multiple fronts, he certainly has created one, and now he knows it. That's at least one reason why he's lashing out in every direction more than usual. His most consequential recent setback came last week when the conservative-led Supreme Court did something it has rarely done during Trump's second term. It ruled against him, striking down his global tariffs as illegal. Two justices who voted with the 6-3 majority, Neil Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett, were nominated by Trump. In his post-ruling tirade, Trump, without mentioning them by name, ripped into them like a recalcitrant employee who failed to do what he hired them to do. Always vote in his favor. On his social media site, he said on Monday, he will refer to the Superior Court with lowercase letters for a while based on complete lack of respect. At the same time, Trump is still threatening a war against Iran. In his latest authoritarian move, he slapped a banner featuring his scowling official portrait on the Justice Department's headquarters in case it wasn't already clear who's running the joint. Cases built on false accusations by federal immigration agents keep getting tossed out of courts. Jeanine Pirro, the U.S. attorney for Washington, D.C., has yet to secure a single indictment against Democratic officials, stalling Trump's revenge tour. If Trump were a child, his temper tantrums could be chalked up to the need for a nap or maybe a dirty diaper. But his behavior seems to stem from surging public rejection. In various states, including some that Trump won, legislators and residents have rejected proposals for massive warehouses to be converted into immigration detention camps. On Tuesday, after weeks of protest from residents, the administration scrapped plans for such a facility in Merrimack, New Hampshire. Neighbors are defending neighbors against federal immigration agents invading their communities with impunity, and Trump's snatch-and-grab immigration enforcement is unpopular, not to mention unconstitutional. Unanswered questions and information from the Justice Department's files on Jeffrey Epstein, the late convicted sex offender and former Trump pal, won't and shouldn't go away, no matter how much Trump wants people to simply move on. Despite his claims, the president has not been, quote, totally exonerated. Trump couldn't even get through the Olympics without insulting and mocking some U.S. athletes instead of celebrating Team USA's 33 medals, including 12 gold-winning performances. With the crucial midterm elections in November, Trump will double down with more of the same and probably worse. But the numbers do not lie. A majority of Americans are fed up with Trump and are pushing back against a corrupt and vindictive administration that doesn't care about their most basic needs. Is this any way to treat an authoritarian? Yes. Yes, it is. I'm going to The Nation now, and this article is Guthrie family offers $1 million reward in search. Mother, 84, was abducted from her home on February 1st. The article has been submitted by Nicholas Bogle Burrows, Tucson. Television news anchor Savannah Guthrie said Tuesday that her family is offering $1 million for information that leads to finding her mother, Nancy, who was abducted from her home more than 3 weeks ago. Guthrie, a Today Show host, made the news offer in a four-minute video posted on Instagram in which she acknowledged that her 84-year-old mother may already be dead, but said the family was holding out hope for a miracle. If Nancy Guthrie has died, she said, the family still needs to know where she is. The family is also donating $500,000 to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, a nonprofit group that works to find missing children and stop children from being sexually exploited. The reward of $1 million is in addition to the current FBI reward of $100,000, and both would be paid to anyone offering information that leads to locating Guthrie. There is also a $100,000 reward being offered by a Tucson-based crime hotline. Quote, if you've been waiting and you haven't been sure, let this be your sign to please come forward, Guthrie said. Tell what you know, help us bring our beloved mother home so that we can either celebrate a glorious, miraculous homecoming or celebrate the beautiful, brave, and courageous and noble life that she has lived. The family's reward will be paid, quote, only for recovery of Nancy Guthrie, end quote, consistent with the FBI's own criteria, Savannah Guthrie said in the caption of her Instagram post. The FBI has said its reward is for information, quote, leading to the location of Guthrie or the conviction of anyone who has been involved in her abduction. Nancy Guthrie disappeared from her home just north of Tucson early in the morning of February 1st. Taken in the dark of night from her bed, Savannah Guthrie said in her newly posted video. The FBI and local sheriff's department have received tens of thousands of tips, but have offered few clues about who might have taken her. The key evidence so far has been 44 seconds of footage from Nancy Guthrie's doorbell camera that showed a masked, armed man approaching her door shortly before her abduction. The Pima County Sheriff's Department publicly ruled out Guthrie's family, including Nancy Guthrie's children and their spouses, as suspects last week. Hundreds of investigators from the department and the FBI are assigned to this case, authorities have said. Savannah Guthrie's video Tuesday was the first time in more than a week that she had spoken publicly. She and her siblings had released several other videos earlier in the investigation, offering to negotiate a ransom payment to the abductor. Since then, however, there has been little discussion from authorities or the family about any purported ransom demands. Over the past 2 weeks, the focus of investigators and the family appears to have turned to trying to generate tips. In her video Tuesday, Guthrie said that she also hoped that people would give her attention to other cases of missing people who are not tied to celebrities like her. We're simply hoping that the attention that has been given to our mom and our family will extend to all families like ours who are in need, Guthrie said. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which is headquartered in Virginia, said on social media that it was grateful to the Guthrie family for turning their personal heartbreak into a commitment for helping others. The disappearance of Nancy Guthrie has inspired a small number of volunteers to launch their own research in the dense desert near her home in the hopes of cracking this case. A small group reported finding a black backpack on Sunday. but it wasn't the same brand as one identified in the video surveillance that the FBI released of the masked person at Guthrie's home the night she disappeared. The Pima County Sheriff's Department said that while it appreciates the concern for Guthrie, it asks people inquiring about volunteering to give investigators space to do their jobs. We all want to find Nancy, but this work is best left to professionals, the agency said in a statement over the weekend. Our next article, 15 states sue the HHS over its revisions to vaccine schedule, target Kennedy and overhaul of advisory panel. The article was submitted by Apoorva Mandavia. Aiming to reverse recent changes to federal vaccine recommendations, 15 states, led by Democrats, announced Tuesday that they were suing the Trump administration. The lawsuit, filed by a coalition of 14 attorneys general and the governor of Pennsylvania, asked the court to nullify the administration's decision in January to reduce the number of diseases children are routinely immunized against to 11 from 17. It also challenges, quote, the unlawful replacement, end quote, of members of the Federal Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices who recommend vaccines for Americans. The suit names the Department of Health and Human Services and Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as defendants. It also names the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and its acting director, Dr. J. Bhattacharya. Yeah. The suit was brought by a group of Democratic states, Arizona, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Minnesota, New Jersey, New Mexico, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin. The governor of Pennsylvania was also part of the suit. The HHS secretary, RFK Jr., and his CDC are flouting decades of scientific research, ignoring credible medical experts, and threatening to strain state resources and make America's children sicker, said Robert Bonta, Attorney General of California, at a briefing on Tuesday. The fact is, vaccines save lives and save our state's money, he also added. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays said, the health and safety of children across the country is not a political issue, is not a culture war talking point. An HHS spokesperson declined to comment on ongoing litigation and referred to a previous statement saying the CDC's update vaccine schedule protects children while aligning U.S. guidance with internal norms. The lawsuit contends that the administration's new vaccination schedule was not based on any scientific evidence, relying instead on comparisons to countries that are significantly different from the United States. The new schedule most closely resembles the recommendations made in Denmark, a country with a nationalized health care and a population that is a fraction of that of the United States. Copying Denmark's vaccine schedule without copying Denmark's healthcare system does not give families more options. It just leaves kids unprotected from serious diseases, said Chris Mays, Attorney General of Arizona. The schedule's announcement bypassed the advisory panel that recommends which shots Americans should receive and when. The committee's decisions have typically guided states in determining the vaccines that require for daycare and elementary school, and in insurance companies are required to cover the shots the members recommend. Kennedy fired all 17 previous panelists in June. The new members he has appointed since share his skepticism of vaccines and mandates. They have rescinded several recommendations for childhood shots, including immunization of all newborns against hepatitis B, a highly infectious virus that can severely damage the liver. The lawsuit by Democratic states is similar to one filed in July by six medical organizations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics. The groups sued the health department after Kennedy announced on social media that COVID vaccines will no longer be recommended for healthy children or pregnant women. They, too, argued that Kennedy and his appointees have made arbitrary and capricious changes to the childhood vaccine schedule, bypassing the usual presence of care, carefully reviewing evidence over months or years before making new recommendations. More than 100 public health experts and organizations filed an amicus brief in support of the lawsuit, which also seeks to reverse the new schedule and to stop the new advisors from meeting. A federal court in Massachusetts heard arguments in that case this month and is expected to rule within the coming days. And now we're going to go to the world of entertainment. In Wonder, the musical, young actors with facial differences find their voices on stage. Written by Michael Casey, coming out of Cambridge. When Max Vogel auditioned to play the lead role in the musical Wonder, he sensed that he was playing a version of himself on stage. Vogel, who was born with bilateral cleft lip and palate, has endured multiple surgeries, like Augie Pullman, 13, to Augie's 28. The 12-year-old from Utah has also been bullied, much like Augie Pullman, who was targeted over his rare genetic condition known as Treacher-Collins syndrome, which causes underdeveloped facial bones and tissue. Quote, "Channeling Augie on stage is actually pretty easy for me because I felt the emotions he has felt, and I've gone through what he has gone through," end quote. Vogel said after a matinee performance at the American Repertory Theater at Harvard University. Vogel, who alternates the role of Augie with Garrett McNally, who has Treacher-Collins syndrome, called the experience pure joy. Adapted from R.J. Palacios' 2012 young adult novel, Wonder, it's a story about the power of kindness and resilience. It revolves around a 10-year-old, Augie, who lives in New York and is attending school for the very first time after years of being homeschooled. The book was also adapted into a popular film in 2017, starring Julia Roberts and Owen Wilson as Augie's parents. Much of the story is about Augie's year at school, where the science whiz and Star Wars fan initially endures stares from fellow students and uncomfortable questions about his face. He considers dropping out of school at one point, but thanks to new friends, his family perseveres and is awarded a medal at graduation for his strength and courage. The musical also explores Augie's journey from the perspectives of those who closest to him, his sister Via, who feels overshadowed by her brother, and his parents, who wrestle with how to protect him while helping him to grow more independent. There's also Jack, who becomes Augie's best friend only to betray him in score points with popular kids. He ends up reconciling with Augie, choosing to do his science project with him rather than the school bully. Director Taibbi Magar encountered Wonder during the height of the pandemic in 2021 when she wasn't sure theater would return. Magar was offered a proposal to turn Wonder into a new musical and came to appreciate how the story shows people a way to live that is a little softer and the world a little softer and a little kinder. "I was pretty sad, and the world was feeling really cold and mean," Magar, who earlier directed Night Side Songs, The Half God of Rain Fell, Macbeth and Stride, and We Live in Cairo, said at the theater. "Then I got a phone call from my agent to take a look at some material, and it just cracked me open. One of the early challenges was finding young actors with facial conditions to portray Augie. The movie features an actor without any facial condition who portrayed the boy wearing makeup and prosthetics." Matthew Joffe, a consultant on the project who is a retired therapist and learning disability specialist, argued that the role really should go to someone with a facial difference. "As someone who has a facial condition known as Möbius syndrome, Joffe feared giving the role to an actor without one risked alienating the community. Quote, "They were so desperate to get actors that they will be able to play the role. They were willing to consider looking for actors and just making them up. And I put my own foot down," he said. quote, the community would be completely outraged and how to know that an actor with an aerofacial condition was being used. Megar said that they never considered casting anyone without a facial difference for the role of Augie. While there were discussions about the practical realities of casting, should the show have commercial life in the coming years, we never considered recasting an actor whose facial differences, she said in a statement. In the end, the production found Vohel and McNally for the parts of Augie. Megar described them as two extraordinary actors. Joffe, who only watched the stage run-through, thought-throughs of the show due to his medical challenges, admitted he was moved to tears. I was basically an emotional basket case, he said. I feel that I was watching my life in front of me. McNally, a 16-year-old from California who has never acted before, saw the post on a Facebook group for a role and thought it would be fun to audition. He related to Augie, he said, because of how people look at him differently. And sometimes they don't treat him as a normal guest and person. When he got on the Zoom call to learn that he was headed to the Northeast to be in a major musical, he was thrilled, but a little anxious that first night. I was nervous because I thought I would mess up on stage. So I was feeling a bit anxious. But it generally went pretty smoothly, except for that one time where I hit my shin on one of the tables, McNally said. Other than that, it was a really good show, and I'm really proud of myself. Sitting beside the new star was his mother, Jules McNally, who never doubted her own son's potential, but was surprised that he was, quote, capable of such a dedication and commitment to the part. As audience watch her son, whom she described, quote, as his own unique person, she hopes the play moves people. I want people to leave the show talking the things that they felt, empathy that they have experienced. I want them to go out into their own communities and do what they need to do to make people feel safe and accepted and welcome. Garrett McNally and Vohel also seem to appreciate how the role of Augie gives them an unexpected platform to change perceptions about those with facial differences. I'm making a difference in helping people understand that, even though some people may look different or have like a facial difference, we're all in the end the same on the inside. We look like because we're all human. It doesn't matter what we look like because we're all human. At one of the last performances, hundreds of screaming schoolchildren filled the theater. The show ended a 2-month run on February 15th. Many, like Dylan Marion, a 14-year-old from Malden, lined up afterwards for autographs, getting seven actors to sign a hard copy of the book. Many had read the book in school and were quick to compare the narrative and what they saw. I loved it. It was amazing, said Ali Sparandara, a 10-year-old from a school in Cambridge whose entire grade read the novel. It's nice he has people out there who can help him. It was a lot of equality. I like it. The book is based on someone with differences that can be shown. It's not like everybody in every book has to be perfect. All right. We're going to take a look at the Insider page. And this is a food article by Ann Trigger Curland. He wants your Nana's greatest hits so he can craft a whole meal around them. Calling all Nanas. Anthony Caterano, chef and owner of Preza in the North End and two Tono restaurants in Wakefield and Gloucester, is on a mission. He's hunting for your grandmother's greatest hits, the homestyle Italian or Mediterranean dish permanently seared into your memory, the one that no restaurant ever quite gets right, one that embodies the spirit of the home cook and that tastes like Sunday at Nana's house and comes with family stories. The idea was sparked by the Netflix film Nana's, inspired by the true story of a Staten Island restaurateur who honored his late mother by opening an Italian spot staffed by grandmothers. Real deal Nana's. Now, in its second year, Caterano has created the Nonna Dinner Series, a five-course Sunday dinner at each of his restaurants built around the recipes that he selects. There's an application on Prezza.com/Nonna. The deadline is March 1st. You may submit an appetizer, salad, pasta, entree, or a dessert recipe, along with the story behind it. The dishes chosen will earn a spot as one of the five courses at Caterano, writes in his application. We're creating a dinner inspired by the love and tradition passed down through generations. So if your family's lasagna, bruschetta, potato gnocchi, or pasta fagioli deserves recognition, Caterano wants to hear about it. Attend a Sunday Nonna dinner featuring these recipes by purchasing a ticket. $100 at each restaurant on the Resi page. March 15th at Tona Wakefield at 175 North Avenue, Wakefield. March 22nd at Prezza in the North End, 24 Fleet Street. March 29th at Tona Gloucester, which is at 2 Main Street on Gloucester. In another food article, this is called A Taste of What's to Come, but the Boston Wine Expo arrives next month. If you're interested in discovering new vineyards and grape varietals and the story behind what's in the glass, make your way to the Boston at Wine Expo on Saturday, March 7th and Sunday, March 8th, held in the Grand Ballroom at the Hilton Boston Park Plaza. Independent from Boston's long-running three-month-long wine and food festival, which started in January, this expo is a two-day tasting event featuring pours from more than 100 wineries across a dozen regions. You'll travel the wine world without leaving the room, from Sicily, Bordeaux, Rhone, and Georgia on the eastern coast of the Black Sea, whose tradition of viticulture stretches back thousands of years. You'll go to Israel, South Africa, Australia, Washington State, and, of course, California, including iconic Chardonnay producers like Camus. It's considered the largest wine tasting event in New England, and winemakers and industry pros will be there eager to talk about what you're sipping. Quote, "This year we have a good mix of everything," end quote, says Expo Director Raphael Scalzi, whose company, Scalzi Hospitality Corporation, originally brought back the annual festival. It took a break in 2018, resuming in 2023, originally introduced in 1991 by the Boston Guild of Oenophilists. The event and took place at the World Trade Center at Seaport Hotel. This event is split into two-hour sessions, 1:30 to 3:30 and 4:30 to 6:30. Excuse me. It leans towards educational rather than imbibing, said Scalzi. It'll be more intimate and comfortable than it has been in the past. Attend a seminar to explore a region. There are a half dozen from a deep dive, or take a deep dive into Chenin Blanc from South Africa, which is taught by Jim Clark, author of Wines of South Africa, to a tasting of Bordeaux wines, co-led by vineyard owner and winemaker Thibault DeCoster, and a class about those Georgian wines held by expert Erica Frey. So whether you're new to swirling and sipping or a seasoned taster, the expo offers plenty to discover. You might find an appreciation for a category that you had once overlooked. Like California Chardonnay, and discover some new favorites to seek out. Tickets for Saturday early grand tasting are $89, while the later session is $93.08. Both Sunday sessions are $93.08. Seminar classes cost $42 to $68, and you may purchase wine tickets at boswineexpo.com. Let's check out the Living Arts section. Let's take a look at some of the shows that are around. At the end of 1958 column in The Observer, defiantly defending his approach to theater in the face of criticism from powerhouse critic Kenneth Tynan, the playwright Eugene Ionesco used variations of the word communicate three times. He said, "A work of art is the expression of an incommunicable reality that one tries to communicate, and which sometimes can be communicated. That's its paradox and its truth." In her inspired, brilliantly executed production of The Bald Soprano at Hub Theater Company, Bryn Boich finds the paradox, the truth, and the possibilities of Ionesco's work. But in The Lesson, which is the second part of the company's double bill of Ionesco one acts, Boich runs head-on into the limitations of his style. At the play's end, she makes matters worse by employing a ham-handed visual coda that's utterly devoid of her usual deft touch. But more on that later. But not much more. Let's linger on the excellence of The Bald Soprano, which premiered in 1950 and established Ionesco, a Romanian-French dramatist, as a leading exponent of what came to be known as the theater of the absurd. Hub Theater Company artistic director Lauren Elias, who deserves credit for infusing the company's work with an achieving spirit, sets the antic tone from the start as Mary, the maid, delivering an amusingly elaborate prologue. Elias, of course, shows up later in The Lesson. The Bald Soprano ostensibly takes place in a Ludner suburb in the middle-class home of Mr. and Mrs. Smith. But Boichi has given the play an extra degree of distance from the naturalism that Ionesco despised by locating it inside of a large television and designed by Julia Lehiu. So we're a live audience watching a play, and we're also a home audience watching a TV. The actors seem to be aware of us, turning to the audience periodically when they, for instance, say the word bizarre with an amusing vehemence. The Smiths' sitcom-ready home is furnished with a blue divan, armchairs on either side, and a large grandfather clock upstage. As the play opens, Mr. Smith, Cleveland Mac Nickel, is hidden behind a newspaper while Mrs. Smith, Siobhan Carroll, chatters gaily. If confusingly, they are joined in due course by visitors. Mr. Martin, played by Brooks Reeves, seemingly channeling Stan Laurel, and Mrs. Martin, Jessica Golden. The actors speak in deliberately bad British accents as the conversation grows more and more disruptive. Christian Mancinas Garcia, who excelled last year as the coldly opportunistic Judge Brack in Apollinaire Theatre Company's production of Ibsen's Hedel Gabler in Chelsea, is a hoot as the hunky fire chief who shows up about midway through The Bald Soprano. The chief immediately asks kindly, immediately kindles the ardor of the women and the men on stage alike. Ionesco likes to toy with language, turn it in upside down, detonate it. In his world, reality is what we say it is, an agreed-upon fiction. Boich's immensely talented cast more than meets the challenge of juggling all of these elements and fusing the considerable comedy of The Bald Soprano with the existential terror it eventually bursts into the household like a fireball. In both modes, the cast heightens and elevates what's on the stage as nonsense morphs from cheerily delivering non sequiturs to words and letters randomly thrown together, human speech as little more than artistry sound. At no point does The Bald Soprano feel like an exercise in a self-indulgent opportunity. The Lesson, alas, she seldom feels like anything else but that. Even the redoubtable Reeves can't say it. He portrayed the rich, devout, and thoroughly clueless Orgon in Bolci's excellent 2024 production of Molière's Tartuffe at Hub Theater Company. In The Lesson, he plays a bow-tied, bespectacled and, as it turns out, unhinged professor. At first, the professor is full of effusive praise for a new pupil when she solves ludicrously easy math problems. But then he begins to throw impossibly complex challenges at her. His vocal volume goes up, way up, as he moves from hectoring to ranting to worse. Ludicrously, as the pupil, a very good Lily Ayotte, a 2022 graduate of Suffolk University, wears pigtails, a necktie, bright red socks, saddle shoes, excuse me, the pupil projects innocence, naivete, and eventually a fierce will as she tries to fight back against the professor by telling him that she has a toothache and she wants the lesson to end. The lesson says what it has to say pretty early about the abuse of power and how the powerful can intensify their grip if they wield it or their authoritarianism in general. But it just keeps making and remarking its portals. One of the last of the diminishing returns kicks in. To return to Ionesco's use of the word paradox, it's notable that while the playwright disdained ideology, at least as an element of the theater, it is the bald soprano, not the overly on-the-nose the lesson, that leaves you thinking about how the distortion of language can undermine a polity. And there are a few other shorter stories. Well, I guess that's going to be it for today. I appreciate you listening, and I hope that you'll listen again tomorrow. My name is Susan. Thank you for listening to the news of the Boston Globe, and have a great day.
These are the obituaries that appear in today's Boston Globe, dated Wednesday, February 25th, 2026. Of Belmont, Mario H. Tachi. Of Boston, Dennis J. McGurk. Of Brighton, Mario H. Tachi. Of Brookline, Gerald S. Parker. Of Framingham, Claude Levy. Of Gloucester, Dennis J. McGurk. Of Hyde Park, Mary Catherine McGinty. Of Ipswich, Edward James Crosser, Jr., Anne Leray Perkins, of Newton, Naomi Miller, Elliot Lewis Serkin, of Roslindale, Mary Catherine McKee, of West Roxbury, Mary Catherine McGinty, Rosalyn Rudy, and of Winthrop, Norman E. Gill. Those are the obituaries that appear in today's Boston Globe, dated Wednesday, February 25th, 2026.
This is the Chef of Love, Chef Gennard, TV host and restaurateur. My grandparents harvested their land to sell food and shared its overflowing bounty with our community. Grandma said, for every yam we pick, we give one away. In the world they cultivated, I love preparing and eating dinner with my family on Sundays. When our resources changed, food assistance programs sustained us. They gave me fuel to start my first culinary business at 16 years old, and inspiration to donate the extra food in my community. Through my life, I've developed an appetite to work with others to ensure everyone has access to the nutritious food we need to thrive. Together, we can help end hunger. Come on, join the movement with Feeding America by volunteering, donating, and advocating. Learn more at feedingamerica.org/act now.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ag Council.
Adopt U.S. Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Today I'm going to help parents translate teen slang. Now, when a teen says something is on fleek, it's exactly like saying, that's rad. It simply means that something is awesome or cool. Another one is totes. It's exactly like saying, totally, just shorter. As in, I totes love going to the mall with Becca. Another word you might hear is jelly. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.